cruelty to horses. So be nice to horses, or your children could end up in Mexico. That's the moral there. And in a surprising move after Russia flexed its military might in the Crimean Peninsula, Ukraine's new leadership has reached out to, again, I'm not making it up, has reached out to oligarchs for help, appointing them as governors in eastern regions where loyalties to Moscow are strong. In other words, bring the people something that they understand. If people in the eastern part of Ukraine, who are mainly identify as Russians and speak Russian, are having a little trouble understanding the notion of Ukraine as a single sovereign nation, send them something that they completely understand. Oligarchs, with their wealth, influence, and self-interest in preventing further conflict, is bad for business, don't you know? You could end up having to give everybody free pizza. The oligarchs could be the key to calming tensions and maintaining Ukraine's control in areas where pro-Russian activists have stoked separatist tensions. And the army's new search for anti-drone technology is the logical next step in what's sure to be a long-lived and a highly profitable new arms race of the 21st century, according to the website Defense Systems, which should know whereof they speak. The Army has issued a sources sought notice for information that could help in developing an affordable counter-unmanned aerial system. You got that? A counter-unmanned aerial system. This is not your usual job application, job notice. Why they need this is because, of course, as the solicitation notes, U.S. forces will be increasingly threatened by reconnaissance and armed unmanned aerial vehicles in the near and far future. So it's finally dawned on the brilliant minds in the U.S. military that sending up drones only sends up other types of technology bent upon bringing the drones down. So what you have to do, this is how things escalate, all right? If you can put the brakes on at pizza, you're okay. Proponents and critics of the Keystone XL are unleashing final flurry of pleas to persuade the government on the pipeline, which has become flashpoint in the debate over energy development versus climate protection. What we're just at the moment where the military itself, in its four-year review, has identified the climate collapse as one of the chief progenitors of terrorism, one of the chief, as the military itself might term it, one of the chief flashpoints in its effort to be the global policeman. And yet here we are in our own backyard. We are building a pipeline which stretches for thousands of miles through virtually uninhabited, which is not to say vital, but just simply uninhabited land. And what do they plan to do? Patrol the whole thing? Are we going to have the army deployed all the way along this pipeline? It seems like we're asking for trouble right there, especially since if we have drones up there watching it, anti-drone, others with anti-drones will also be watching the drones, watching the pipeline. And the public had until the end of yesterday evening to be part of the official review of whether the Keystone is in fact in the national interest. After that, Secretary of State John Kerry will weigh in, and then President Barack Obama will decide to approve or scrap the long delayed. Well, at this point, it's nearly $5.5 billion that we're in for, though that figure is probably much that's lowballing it, and it's very likely that no one really knows how much the Keystone XL will inevitably cost. One thing we do know is that hauling oil, piping oil to refineries on the Gulf, where the oil itself is extremely expensive to refine, is the most expensive way of producing energy. That said, the weather, mostly sunny around Cascadia, they say, and a high near 61 with a south wind. Well, okay, mostly sunny. And tonight, patchy fog, otherwise overcast, lows around 43, light east winds, and into the weekend, rain, patchy fog, highs around 64, not much in the way of wind, and Saturday night, lows around 52. And that's when the wind starts to pick up again, people. 8 to 15, gusting up to 24, and it's an absolute dead sure thing that it's going to rain all night, according to the National Weather Service. For Sunday, highs near 58, still a little bit breezy. Sunday night, it's 50-50 as far as rain is concerned. Otherwise, lows around 45. Bring us full circle to a glorious Monday morning when it all starts all over again. I do have your alternative forecast today. The moon is 6 days old. It's a root moon in Taurus. The synodic forecast, a good time to sow vegetables that produce internal seed-bearing fruits. Yeah, might as well get out there and start, take your soil's temperature and then get out there. Certain things do well at this temperature, not everything. And there are ways of just as we amend the soil, you can amend the heat by adding some hot manure. And biodynamically speaking, the moon in Taurus, it's an earth sign. It's a good time to sow root plants. Not so good for flowering plants like broccoli and cauliflower and globe artichokes. You're eating flowers when you eat those things, you know. Then the sidereal forecast moon in Taurus, it's a good time for root vegetables, especially when hardiness and drought conditions is needed. Okay, so if you're growing potatoes, and we don't expect much rain, and we don't, and we do grow potatoes, now's a good time. Get them started. That's it for both the alternative and the conventional forecast. And we have news stories from all around Cascadia. This has been an extraordinary week, and it is important. Important to point out and to bear in mind that happenings around the world, in Ukraine, in Syria, sub-Saharan Africa, North Africa, all around the world right now, there are tensions. And we spoke earlier in the program about flashpoints. Flashpoints, we've got them. The U.S. military, despite all of its reviews, despite global awareness, despite extraordinary might and heft globally, it's still, we are unable to predict something like what happened in Ukraine, despite the fact that the entire world was watching. They weren't watching Ukraine, they were watching the Olympics, but they were there, they were very close by. In Sochi, one could look at Abkhazia, these regions, Abkhazia, Chechnya, Georgia, all of these regions have for many decades been places to keep an eye on, because there are ethnic tensions, there are ethnic animosities, which before in the past could be resolved with a large stick and some yelling. And now people who have long-standing grievances with one another have the types of armaments that start some very serious conflicts. And the fact that with all of our spy capabilities, the NSA, drones, the whole works, we were not able to predict what happened in Ukraine. Yeah, maybe Chuck Hagel is worth listening to. Maybe we do need to scale back as far as the military is concerned, because what is the point of having any of this if it leads to nothing more than bashing one another over the head with sticks and rocks? It's really virtually come down to that. This has been Air Cascadia for Friday, March 7th, 2014. Sam Parrish, engineer the show today. Thank you so much for that, Sam. Kathleen Stevenson is the KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Chris Andre. Get the facts. Know your rights. Take a stand. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.
Sponsoring an evening on the future of schooling in Portland at the Clinton Street Theater on Thursday, March 13th. It starts at 6 p.m. with a panel discussion that addresses what's ahead for public schools after the recent fierce contract battle, the case against high-stakes testing in privatizing schools, why public schools produce higher test score performances than private schools, and how we can work together to create truly wonderful schools. Speakers include Gwen Sullivan, president of the Portland Teachers Union, also school board member Steve Buell, and folks from the High School Student Union and Oregon Save Our Schools, a parent group. After discussion, we will present the film The Inconvenient Truth About Waiting for Superman. It's a film that debunks the attack on public education and teachers' unions. It all happens on Thursday, March 13th at the Clinton Street Theater at 6 p.m.
Flashpoints. We'll spend the entire hour on a special Fukushima update, 3 years after what many experts have called the worst nuclear accident in history. I'm Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. We're going to spend the entire hour taking a look at Fukushima. We're going to be doing more next week. It is coming up on the three-year anniversary of this devastating disaster, and they still don't have these reactors under control, although you can hear lots of different kinds of stories. So let me tell you who's joining us up first. We're joined by Kevin Camps and Cindy Folkers. They both work with a very important organization, Beyond Nuclear. Kevin Camps is the radio waste specialist at Beyond Nuclear, and Cindy is Beyond Nuclear's radiation and health specialist. I want to welcome you both to Flashpoints. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Dennis.
Thanks, Dennis.
All right, let's start with you, Kevin. You said today the condition of the high-level radioactive waste storage pools at Fukushima Daiichi reactors remains perilous. Please take a few minutes to talk about why you use the word perilous.
Well, the most that we know is about the Unit 4 high-level radioactive waste storage pool at Fukushima Daiichi. That was the building that suffered a large-scale explosion in the early days of this catastrophe. Incredibly enough, there was no fuel in the core of that reactor, luckily, on the day that the tsunami struck. But hydrogen gas flowed over from Unit 3 and blew the building up anyway. And the building was so badly damaged that it was precariously close to the brink of just simply collapsing. And unfortunately, since the reactor waste was not in the reactor, it was in the pool. And so if that pool had collapsed, a fire could have ensued within a matter of hours that would not have been able to be put out. And it would have dwarfed in size, in magnitude, in quantity, the hazardous radioactivity releases that we've seen in the last 3 years. So over the course of 2011 to 2013, Tokyo Electric rebuilt the infrastructure of that building to try to prevent its collapse. They have kind of a new exoskeleton around the building that's strong enough to hold a crane that can lift these 90-ton waste transfer casks down to the ground. And so very slowly, 1,500 fuel assemblies are being unloaded from that pool. Incredibly enough, they took the holiday off for 2 weeks as a vacation. Because they're not out of the woods yet, a big earthquake hitting that site could still be enough to collapse that building or collapse the pool within that building. And it would be a global catastrophe that would dwarf what's happened already. And we come to find out, an analysis by Arne Gunderson at Fairwinds Analysis, that the Unit 3 pool is probably, and we know much less about the situation there, is probably in a much worse state of affairs than Unit 4. There are 50 tons of extraneous debris that fell back into the Unit 3 pool from the largest of the explosions that took place on that site.
Now, are there still releases going into the ocean?
Yes. That has to do with the groundwater flow that the builders of Fukushima Daiichi Nuclear Power Plant knew about this issue back in the 1960s. A lot of groundwater flows under the site. It comes down from the mountains and flows out into the ocean. Right now, what's happening is these shattered buildings, the groundwater flow is mixing with really nuclear fuel that has found its way out of the reactors, out of the reactor pressure vessels, out of the containment structures, and there is mixing of this tremendous contamination with the groundwater flow. They're able to capture something like 400 tons per day, and they're putting it up in a storage tank farm behind the reactors up the hillsides, but they're not able to capture 300 tons. That goes into the ocean every day. It contains a alphabet soup of radioactive poisons, tritium, strontium-90, cesium-137, that's flowing out into the ocean. And that's another shoe that could drop at Fukushima Daiichi, is the 1,000-plus tanks, and these are large-size tanks, could, under an earthquake, simply let loose their contents. And we're talking approaching 150 million gallons of highly radioactive water in those tanks. And they have had leaks. Just last week or 2 weeks ago now, they had a leak of 100 tons. It was an overflow incident where a worker left three valves in a row open and too much water went into one of these tanks and it just overtopped. And 100 tons fell onto the ground with radioactive strontium-90 concentrations just off the charts. And so that is going to join the groundwater flow and likely find its way out to sea.
Kevin, what is life like